Our newsletter description of this Sunday said that some congregants would share reflections about their summer experiments in what spiritual teacher and author Andrew Harvey calls sacred activism. You might recall from my August 17th talk that the heart of sacred activism is action that's taken in the service of justice that is free of emotional toxins like blame, rage, and demonization of the opposition. It is determined, sometimes fierce action, but it remains grounded in deep inner peace and inclusive love, even for those who we may be battling against on the surface. Well, it turned out that the folks who might have shared with us today weren't readily available. So we're going to take an equally rich exploratory path to the subject by checking out how three diverse Unitarian Universalists put the values of their faith into action. I want to first credit the Dictionary of Unitarian and Universalist Biography, an online resource of the Unitarian Universalist History and Heritage Society, for the wealth of information from which I drew the two stories I'll share in my sermon. By the way, believe it or not, exploring the online Dictionary of Unitarian and Universalist Biography is a wonderful and interesting way to get to know aspects of our faith, because there are stories of people who lived it, just like good documentaries of biographies can be very fascinating. So check it out sometime. It's really worth it. It's UUDB.org, UUDB.org. But this first shorter story, which serves as our reading today, is abridged from a 2007 UU World Magazine story by Jane Greer. I am sorry to report that it's not a happy tale, but I still thought it was important to share, because unfortunately it still has all too much resonance with national events we've seen in the past few weeks. So this is our first story of a UU sacred activist. More than 40 years after she was murdered, Unitarian Universalist civil rights worker Viola Liuzzo of Detroit was posthumously inducted into the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame on October 25, 2006. The 39-year-old Liuzzo was killed on the night of March 25, 1965, by members of the Ku Klux Klan as she was driving another civil rights worker to Montgomery, Alabama, at the conclusion of the march from Selma to Montgomery. Liuzzo was born Viola Gregg in Pennsylvania in 1925. During her childhood, she lived in parts of the South, witnessing racial discrimination firsthand. The family then moved to Ypsilanti, Michigan, and Liuzzo later moved to Detroit. Twice divorced and the mother of five children, she joined the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Detroit in 1964. She also became active in the Detroit chapter of the NAACP and drove to New York City to attend a United Nations Civil Rights Seminar sponsored by the Unitarian Universalist Association. Liuzzo was known for her passionate embrace of social justice causes. Before becoming active in civil rights, she was an advocate for education and economic justice reform and was arrested twice, in both cases requesting a trial to publicize her cause. In 1965, like many Americans, Viola Liuzzo followed civil rights developments in the South closely, especially on television. When the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King issued a call for religious leaders to come to Alabama after state troopers attacked marchers with billy clubs and tear gas as they crossed the Edmund Pettit Bridge in Selma, Liuzzo took the call to heart. She drove her 1963 Oldsmobile to Selma, intending to stay for a week. She volunteered at the Roy Brown African Methodist Episcopal Church and used her car to drive protesters back and forth from Selma to Montgomery. On March 25, Liuzzo was giving a ride to fellow civil rights worker Leroy Moton when four Klansmen pulled their car alongside hers and shot her. Liuzzo was killed instantly while Moton was able to escape. Although she was initially lauded as a hero by the local press after her death, the media soon began running stories that described her as a drug addict, sexually promiscuous, and a bad wife and mother. Many believe that the FBI supplied these stories because an FBI informant, Gary Thomas Rowe, was in the group of four men that shot her, and the agency wanted to divert attention from this fact. Mary Campbell is the coordinator of interdisciplinary studies at Davenport University's campus in Warren, Michigan, and she said that she became fascinated with the case as a child growing up in Detroit. Quote, "Women always gathered at my mother's house. I remember some of them being very confused about what had happened to Viola Liuzzo. She was a hero for 3 days, and then all of these negative reports started to appear. They weren't sure they supported her." Campbell remembers her mother saying that there must be more to the story. "Even as a 10-year-old, I knew that no person could go down there to risk their life and be guilty of what these reports implied." Of the 4 men accused of killing Liuzzo, 3 were given 10-year prison sentences, not for murder, but for violating Liuzzo's civil rights. The 4th, Klansman and FBI informant Gary Thomas Rowe, testified for the prosecution and received immunity. In the late 1970s, Liuzzo's children attempted to sue the FBI for complicity in their mother's death, but that case failed. Viola Liuzzo was one of 8 women inducted into the Michigan Hall of Fame at the October 25, 2006 ceremony. Mary Campbell gave the nominating address, and Liuzzo's sister and daughter accepted the award on her behalf. Well, nothing but peace and freedom and equality was enough for a woman named Lydia Maria Child, the first of the other two sacred UU activists that we're going to explore today. Actually, she was a Unitarian because the Unitarians and Universalists had not merged at that point. That didn't happen until 1961. And Lydia Maria Child was born the youngest of 7 children in Medford, Massachusetts in 1802, a century and a half before that consolidation happened. She attended local schools and Medford's First Parish, an Orthodox congregational church. Baptized in 1821, she thereafter preferred her baptismal name, Maria. She was quite the inherent talent, and in 1824, at the age of about 22, she wrote the book Homobok, A Tale of Early Times, the first historical novel published in the United States. It drew on her experience with Indians in Maine some years prior, and the work sketched a highly sympathetic picture of Native Americans, then commonly thought of as savages. It was published anonymously, but Child was soon celebrated as the author and became an overnight sensation. She continued to write novels, stories, and nonfiction works and became editor of a popular children's magazine. It was one of the first of its kind. But it was in 1831, with the now married Maria Child nearing age 30, that her deeper passion for sacred activism was unleashed. When prominent and radical abolitionist leader William Lloyd Garrison began publication of his abolitionist newspaper, The Liberator, Maria later recalled that he, quote, "got hold of the strings of my conscience and pulled me into reform. Old dreams vanished, old associations departed, and all things became new." Hence is the power of a progressive, egalitarian vision. So she left her former pursuits and lent her support to Garrison and the Boston Female Anti-Slavery Society and applied her formidable writing talents to the cause. Another excerpt from the UU Biography website describes the results this way. publication of an appeal in favor of that class of Americans called Africans in 1833 marked a turning point in Child's career. Outspoken in her condemnation of slavery, she pointed out its contradiction with Christian teaching, described the moral and physical degradation it brought upon slaves and owners alike, and did not accept the North from its share of responsibility for the system. And in her introduction to that book, Child gorgeously captures some of the essence of a sacred activist. "I am fully aware of the unpopularity of the task I have undertaken. But though I expect ridicule and censure, it is not in my nature to fear them." And like many justice pioneers, she and her husband David were ridiculed and censured by the establishment. Sales of her books plummeted, publishers refused to consider anything she wrote, and she lost her editorial post with the children's magazine. But she was undeterred. And from 1841 to 43, Lydia Marie Child served as editor of the weekly New York newspaper of the American Anti-Slavery Society. Her first editorial expressed the convictions of a sacred activist. "Such as I am here, ready to work according to my conscience and my ability, providing nothing but diligence and fidelity, refusing the shadow of a fetter on my free expression of opinion from any man or body of men, and equally careful to respect the freedom of others, whether as individuals or societies." 2 years later, discord within the abolitionist movement caused her to resign the position and withdraw from the movement, but she continued to write. One outcome was 1854's three-volume work, The Progress of Religious Ideas Through Successive Ages. She was known for those kind of trite little light works. She intended this book, or these volumes, to remove, quote, "the superstitious rubbish from the sublime morality of Jesus Christ, and to give considerate attention to other religions as well." Despite impeccable research and positive reviews, the work didn't sell well, one commentator saying that it was, quote, "too learned for a popular book and too popular for a learned book." But soon after her core passion was rekindled. Abolitionist John Brown's doomed raid on the U.S. government's Harper's Ferry arsenal, according to Maria, quote, "stirred me up to consecrate myself with renewed earnestness to the righteous cause for which he died so bravely." And though nearing age 60 in the winter of 1860 and 1861, she drove to Boston or rode to Boston often for activist works, saying that when there is anti-slavery work to be done, I feel as young as 20. And when the Civil War broke out, she gathered supplies for slaves who were fleeing the South and compiled her Freedman's Book, an instruction manual designed to help former slaves learn to read. After the war, Maria supported the women's suffrage movement and renewed her work on behalf of Native Americans. And when a group of Unitarians founded the Free Religious Association in 1867, she found common company, and she attended meetings regularly throughout her stays in Boston. In 1878, she published her, quote, "eclectic Bible of quotations from the world religions," stating that her motive was to do all I can to enlarge and strengthen the bond of human brotherhood. Child is now mainly remembered as the author of the Thanksgiving poem that became a song, "Over the River and Through the Wood." But an excerpt from our online Dictionary of Unitarian and Universalist Biography more accurately sums up her life as a sacred activist. Quote, "a novelist, editor, journalist, and scholar who produced a body of work remarkable for its brilliance, originality, and variety, much of it inspired by a strong sense of justice and love of freedom. Little known today, in her own time, she was a famously radical abolitionist. She was a student of world religions with a breadth of vision and understanding extraordinary for her time, and she deserves an honored place in American and in Unitarian history." When she died on October 20th, 1880, Wendell Phillips gave the eulogy at a service held in her Wayland, Massachusetts home. He stated that Lydia Marie Child was, quote, ready to die for a principle and starve for an idea. We felt that neither fame, nor gain, nor danger, nor calumny, aka defamation, had any weight with her. And after a lifetime of committed sacred activism, she was buried beside her late husband in the town's old burial ground. And I didn't plan it this way, but I have no doubt that she would have been thrilled to meet our second sacred UU activist. Because the Reverend Joseph Jurdon is a sparkling example of the rightness of Child's unyielding abolitionist convictions. I want to explain, if you ever look this up, that Jurdon is pronounced Jurdon, but it's spelled Jordan. I don't know why that difference, but it's very clear in the biography. In 1882, Joseph Jurdon explains that he was born a free black man in West Norfolk, Virginia. Like many free blacks of this coastal region, he became an oyster man as a youth. But at 21, he moved to Norfolk to seek greater fortunes. There he married and tried several occupations, laborer, grocer, finally carpenter. And as a carpenter, he earned enough money to build or buy several houses in a Norfolk suburb and was eventually able to live off the rent. Literate, skilled, and now a property owner, Jurdon was among the elite of free Southern blacks. Religious questions called deeply to him, and in 1880, he had been ordained a Baptist minister. But a few years later, a Methodist minister gave him Thomas Whitmore's book, The Plain Guide to Universalism, and asked his opinion. In his biography's words, Whitmore's book explains the goodness of the universe, the loving parental guidance of the Almighty for all of humanity, and the promise of salvation for all. It made clear that universalism was not a religion for the bigoted, but for those who could accept that God's love is extended equally to all, the powerless and the powerful, the oppressed and their oppressors. By contrast, the prevailing attitudes among blacks in the 1880s, as subjugation and segregation became increasingly implanted in Southern society, was that white suppressors would surely suffer in hell. That's the end of that quotation. And the book's theology struck Jurdon like a train. He began to devour all he could on the subject of universalism, and he soon found himself no longer able to preach the Baptist faith. And he continued carpentry work while he pondered his next steps. Learning that there was a significant community of Unitarian and Universalists in Philadelphia, in 1886, Jurdon traveled there and called on the minister of the Universalist Church of the Messiah, Edwin C. Sweetser. Now, the way that's worded, I realized, is that it couldn't be read two ways. He traveled there and called on the minister of the Universalist Church of the Messiah, Edwin C. Sweetser. Or he went there and called on the minister of the Universalist Church of the Messiah, Edwin C. Sweetser. Talk about your sacred activists. Anyway, Jurdon ended up studying under Sweetser for 7 months, which solidified his growing faith. Returning to Norfolk, he began to preach universalism to anyone who would listen. He rented a room as a chapel and used his carpentry skills to fashion a pulpit. He quickly had a 20-family congregation who on June 29, 1867, formally organized themselves as a universalist mission. Jurdon then asked his mentor, Reverend Sweetser, whether he could become a recognized universalist minister. Sweetser referred the issue to the Universalist General Convention, akin to what is now the Unitarian Universalist Association. And after a series of required steps and evaluations, a Universalist ordaining council of 3 ministers and 4 laypersons unanimously recommended him. On March 31st, 1889, Joseph Jurdon was ordained. The Universalist denomination had welcomed its first African-American minister. The Universalist General Convention quickly admitted his church into fellowship, and the rented room he'd converted into a chapel soon bore a sign, the First Universalist Church of Norfolk. It was soon so crowded that a larger space was needed, and local parents increasingly pleaded with Jurdon to establish a school. Jurdon agreed to do all he could to meet this urgent need, and in 1893, he implored the General Convention to fund a building in Norfolk. Donations were strong enough to build a church and buy some of the furnishings, and in November of 1894, the new sanctuary and church schoolroom, set in the center of Norfolk's black community, but occasionally attended by white Universalists who had no church in the region, was dedicated. In one explicit melding of sacred activism, Jordan felt that the church and education went hand in hand to empower people in their community. And each week, he and others taught school to 90 or 100 community children who might otherwise have had their education denied. The Universalist missionary Quillen Shin organized a chapter of the Universalist youth organization there, proclaiming that no one can be a Universalist whose love did not take in all races and colors of men. He added that if the glad Universalist message had been understood and obeyed, black people would never have been slaves. But Universalism was radical in its social implications, and it was debated by the local black press. Jordan's Universalist Church was sometimes seen as a competitor to neighboring traditional churches. And as a national institution, it was largely white and still segregationist. Radical equality through mutual love and respect was still a challenging doctrine in the Jim Crow South. And while the school remained vital, the congregation lost key people and eventually declined. Just in his 50s, Joseph Jordan died in June 1901 of an unknown disease. The funeral was held in the church he founded, and ministers from other black churches attended, suspicion about Universalism having eased some. But without steady leadership, the First Universalist Church of Norfolk and its day school declined and closed in 1906. Yet the church and the school had done fantastic work in its community, work with true and lasting effects through the education of citizens. It also founded a Universalist mission in Suffolk, Virginia, and proceeds from Jordan's estate were now used to support it. The Suffolk mission prospered, and until 1984, remained a vital legacy of Reverend Jordan. His calling to the Universalist faith and his sacred activist service to his community was secure. So we never know how things flow. Lydia Maria Child is doing abolitionist work along with many others, and it's very possible that Joseph Jordan might have had a much harder time reaching the heights that he did had slavery still been the law of the land. So just a few other thoughts to wrap up. The first is that sacred activism takes many forms. Lydia Maria Child used her literary skills to bang the drum of freedom and equality. Joseph Jordan took the measure of freedom available to him and spread hope and education in his oppressed community. Different paths, but linked by common threads of compassion, conviction, and courage. And in both cases, these threads were largely woven and strengthened by their connection to religious community. A living black UU minister, the Reverend Mark Morrison Reed, named the essence of this when he wrote, "The central task of the religious community is to unveil the bonds that bind each to all. There is a connectedness, a relationship discovered amid the particulars of our own lives and the lives of others. Once felt, it inspires us to act for justice. It is the religious community that assures us that we are not struggling for justice on our own, but as members of a larger community. The religious community is essential, for alone our vision is too narrow to see all that must be seen, and our strength too limited to do all that must be done. Together, our vision widens, and our strength is renewed." And right here, right now, you are a part of this heritage of widening vision and greater strength. We are here, each of us, to find or to bolster our own version of sacred activism, our own best efforts to create an environmentally sound, socially just, and spiritually fulfilling world, a world that works for all. In part, we do this by learning from examples like Jordan and Child. And we also do our own inner spiritual work. No less a sacred activist than Nelson Mandela underscored the importance of this aspect when he said, "The first thing is to be honest with yourself. You can never have an impact on society if you have not changed yourself. Great peacemakers are all people of integrity, of honesty, of humility." So sacred activists do their inner work, and then they bring that out into the world. And that's part of why we're here. And we don't have to do that perfectly, not even close. Because as Mandela also said, "I am not a saint, unless you think of a saint as a sinner who keeps trying." So keep coming here to get fortified. Then get out there on your own sacred activist path and keep walking, keep trying. Blessed be.